But then because of he's like,
oh, yes. Bring up Senator Rowland. Bring
That's
him
right. The Senate Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness are coming to order. Colleagues, we have three public hearings today. We're going to ask our elected officials to come forward and go through two of these first, and then we will recess those and come back to them. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on SB 531. Council, very briefly, so everybody lines it up, and then we will let the good commissioner and the good senator speak, and then we'll move on.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 531 creates a Rural Fire Protection District Community Development Task Force to study how rural fire protection districts can help facilitate community development following a disaster, and requires a report to the legislature by September 15th of 2018 and sunsets December 31st of 2018. It has a couple of subsequent referrals, first to the Senate Committee on General Government Accountability and then to Joint Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. Arnie Rowland, State Senate District 5, which is part of the Oregon coast from Coos Bay to Tillamook Bay and into the valley in Sheridan and Falls City. This came from the Rural Fire District people in Toledo, Oregon, and their issue, and I think Lincoln County has been one of the counties that's taken more seriously than others, the whole idea of how do we prepare for and then not only prepare for but recover after we've had a big event like an earthquake or tsunami. And they were looking around and realizing when this thing happens, they are it. They're going to be in the rural communities. They're the ones that have most of the training with regard to emergency preparedness and taking care of people and then figuring out how to do it. And so they decided it would probably be in the best interest of the state if we got our rural fire departments and those others to have a conversation about recovery, response, and what things they can add to the community, and then start having a community conversation. Lincoln County has been developing these caches of materials around the district with some slight little money coming them by the county, and you'll hear about that, and then making sure that there are available places that people know about where there's going to be caches of food and other kinds of things to get them through those first few days, and then an assessment after that, and that's where the rural fire departments come in, about what buildings are safe to be in, to occupy, what other kinds of things are going to be necessary for the 2 or 3 months before we really expect to get a whole lot of help in our rural areas. And so this is an attempt from that one rural fire department who's been looking at it, saying we need to get together as a group and have a conversation about what kinds of things we need to have on hand to prepare for the upcoming event. We could do it with a work group or whatever. They came up with this as the possibility, and it's here for you today. Thank you.
So I'm Kerry Thompson, ex-legislator and county commissioner from Lincoln County. This came up exactly like he said. We have taken seriously trying to prepare people. And the group of people that we haven't prepared well for is your citizens for the rest of the state. You're traveling on rural roads, coming to the coast, coming to eastern Oregon. And if you're out there and you have a earthquake or a snowstorm like we had last winter, blinding snowstorm, and you're trapped in your car out there, we could have several hundred people that are trying to get someplace for protection. And in like in Eddyville, they don't have the housing. They do have a school there that might work it, but they don't have the cash of food supplies. In Lincoln County, we took $30,000 to start it. We started a matching program to prepare for food supplies in case of a disaster, because we had no food supplies. We had disaster areas, but we didn't have the preparation materials. Well, that started and has been a great success. We've, over the years now, built up all these little isolated communities. They have the option to get the materials they need. One of them even went as far as to get some tents, so because they knew they were next to a helicopter landing site, to have tents so they could build a triage unit there. Others have bought generators, and most of them have bought food and water and stored them. So what the concept was to say, okay, this rural fire protection district is out here in an isolated area, and we'll figure out how to get them food and water supplies, but they don't have space in order to protect the amount of citizens that might be on the highways. And then I got thinking about it. Well, this is bigger than just Eddyville. We need a group to go out and examine all up and down around the state how many of these major highways are isolated communities that need a protection spot. And that's why this bill's here, and Arnie sponsored it. I think it has potential to help all citizens of the state of Oregon if it's done right.
Thank you. questions? Please, Senator.
I relate to this quite closely. Back in 1975, when I lived in Ohio, we had a huge snowstorm with about 50 or 60 mile an hour winds, and the wind chill was like 20 below zero. And I lived in a town of 500 people along a main highway, but about about a mile and a half from the main highway. And we had people up and down that highway stranded in their cars. They got stuck. They couldn't go anywhere. They didn't have heat. I recall a lady with her two children, and they had a Labrador in the back seat. That's the only thing that kept them warm.
Yep.
And we were able to go out and get all these people off, but the concern we had was food. Well, we got permission to go out and get the semis and break their locks and take all the food out of the semis. I appreciate wholeheartedly what you're saying, and it's better to be prepared and ready for it and not have to use it than not be prepared when it comes. So wholeheartedly support this. Thank you, Senator Roblin.
Thank you.
Can I also mention, this idea of the food supplies? I've dropped another bill, but it hasn't had a hearing yet, to try to explain how this worked. It's been hugely successful in Lincoln County. We just simply made a situation so that a community could apply to our limited amount of funds of $30,000. It's an equal match, and then they can do what their community needs rather than somebody trying to tell them what to do. We supervise it and look at it to see if it is something that we think fits the criteria. But if they said this is what they need in their area, and then once the money's gone, it's gone. But over the years now, it's built up to be a large amount of food caches in our county. A similar thing could be done in the state for not too much money, given we don't know how many years you've got to do it. So that's the idea and concept. It's this, and in our county it works. I'm trying to say that this is a possibility for the state to do something good for all of us.
And Lincoln County has done an exceptional job of doing this. We've actually had your EMS people in and the school people in, and Lincoln County is certainly leading the way.
Yeah.
And by no small effort of the commissioners, I probably assess. Senator Roblin, I do have to ask you the technical questions. Would you be willing to help with this effort?
Yes.
Okay. So we'll call it. Because, there are certain classifications of task forces.
Yes, there are.
And we are actually looking at some rather interesting ways to do that at this committee, but we still need help
outside
from other members.
Yep.
There is no one else actually signed up for SB 531, so I'm going to close the public hearing on SB 531 and open a public hearing on SB 707.
Okay. For the record, Arnie Roblin, State Senator, District 5, Coos Bay to Tillamook Bay and over into the valley. This bill is one that is really important to me. I was fortunate enough in the House to be involved in the building of the wings, and I felt that was a really good attempt at starting to get this building back in the shape it needs to be in and do some things. When they started deconstructing those buildings and we found out how unsafe it was pretty remarkable to me. But we didn't finish the project. The project was, we need the main part of the Capitol building secure and built in a way that you can actually use drinking fountains, that you can actually have electrical units that work, and is safe in the case of a catastrophic event. A lot of people got upset with that and said we need to spend the money on kids first. I care about kids, and I want the kinds of things to happen in those places. But I don't know how many of you noticed, but if you go outside here, you'll see a lot of kids. We have lots of school kids that come to this building every year, and they don't usually end up in the wings. They end up in the main part of the Capitol, which is the part that is going to structurally fail. As a member of the foundation, this bill became really important to me because I think we missed an opportunity a few years ago, and I want to make sure that we keep this on everybody's mind. Our main capital needs to be structurally sound. It is the seat of our government. We need to have an opportunity to run government out of that building if and when that catastrophic event happens, and it needs to be structurally sound so people can get out of it and we can make it the building that it should be. So you've got some other people here from the foundation. I'm going to talk some more, and I have to go run a committee. So any questions, I'd be glad to answer.
I'm not going to let Jeff quite so. I mean,
no,
I was just trying to send the door, but I want you to ask you a couple questions first. If we were able to broaden this, and I'm looking at the rating clause because the rating clause is wide enough. If Article 11 end bonds were a better way to go, would you be amenable to that?
I would be.
And if there was some word tweaking, including emergency preparation and security preparation of the building.
This whole thing is about making sure that our structures are available and that there are opportunities to serve the communities that they exist in the future. So absolutely.
Right. Okay. I appreciate your questions. Mm-hmm. Please.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Your Honor, is it your position that the state capitol should be prepared and retrofitted for the earthquake that's coming?
Absolutely.
Is it your position that the Oregon legislature should allocate bonds to make that happen?
I believe we have a responsibility to do so.
When should the Oregon legislature do that, please, Your Honor?
Well, they should have done it a few years ago, but I would accept tomorrow as an okay time, too.
Your Honor, can I continue to ask another question, please?
The chair, not the judge, because I'm not a lawyer like you, esteemed Mr. President, but Senator Courtney, you may proceed.
So do you believe that this legislature, the 79th legislature, should take that action, Your Honor?
Personally, yes.
Personally?
I personally believe that it
is. As a legislator or personally, Your Honor?
Personally, as a legislature, it should take that action. See.
Do you feel intensely about this, Your Honor?
I have for a long time.
Have you? I'm trying to feel the intensity.
I tend to be a calm person,
Do you think that the magnitude of the project should, if necessary, mean the legislature should be, along with us, leave this building for a period of time to make sure that the comprehensive nature of the project can be completed in an efficient, proper, safe way, Your Honor?
If we had to do it in a tent outside, I'd be fine.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you for indulging. I just wanted to thank you, sir.
What size tent would you like?
I got two or three in mind. They make them big enough, believe me.
Okay, with that, thank you.
Thank you,
Senator,
very much.
Please go on to your additional duties. I'm going to ask Mr. Wilhelms to come up here first, and then following that, we will have a panel. That you caused me much heartburn over a flag. I'm going to take my opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name's Gary Wilhelms, formerly Honorable. I live in unincorporated Washington County, and I'm here today representing the Oregon State Capitol Foundation, of which I am a founding member, and also myself, since I've had some involvement in this project over the last 11 years or so. Senate Bill 707 approves the bonding necessary to finance the project known as the Capitol Master Plan, or more recently as the Oregon State Capitol Renovation Project. The main reason for the project and the most significant cost item is the seismic upgrade of the Capitol building. The primary concern is life safety for those who work in and for those who visit the building. However, in the interest of full disclosure, the plan does include some items that would be considered modernization, remodeling, or upgrades to the 79-year-old building. While there were earlier calls for individual items, the need for the overall project was really identified by the Public Commission on the Oregon Legislature back in 2005-2006. The wings were remodeled in 2007-08 without seismic upgrades. In 2008, the legislature retained SRG Partnership Incorporated to develop the Oregon State Capitol Master Plan, which included the seismic upgrades and other improvements to the entire building, both the wings and the 1938 building. The proposed project was developed during 2008-09 and presented to the legislature in June of 2009. It then sat on the shelf until the legislature created the Capitol Master Plan Review Committee in 2012. This committee reviewed the original master plan, recommending a few amendments. And most significantly, it recommended a timeline and a funding process to complete the project, and it delivered its final report to the legislature in February of 2013. In 2013, the legislature approved $34.5 million in bonding to finance the design phase of the project. The design phase was largely completed using about 25 of the $34.5 million. Those of us with keen interest in the project were very optimistic about getting approval in the 2015 session for the $300 million in bonding needed to complete the project. It did not happen. I'm not here to discuss the reasons why funding for the project was unsuccessful in 2015. I would, however, like to mention that the concern of legislators to fund the seismic rehabilitation of public schools before they did the Capitol building is being met. As you will recall, $175 million was set aside for the Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Program and an additional $125 million for matching funds to assist school districts with making improvements to aging facilities. I checked with Business Oregon, who administers the grant program. They did $50 million in grants in 2016 and are doing an additional $120 million in 2017. So the program is working, and while it may take time, the concern for public schools is being met. I believe it is reasonable, therefore, for the legislature to once again turn its attention to the Capitol building. During the 2015 session, the legislature did approve $50 million for the Capitol Accessibility, Maintenance, and Safety project, now known lovingly as CAMS, which will complete some of the items found in the Capitol Master Plan. The CAMS project will be underway until 2019. And since, when the blanks are filled in, Senate Bill 707 would likely be an ask in the range of $250 to $300 million, legislators just might not be eager to support it during this legislative session. However, legislators should be willing to step up because, first of all, the 79-year-old building needs the work in terms of both public safety and restoration. Secondly, the Capitol building is the only building for which the legislature has direct responsibility. The work is going to be done eventually. If it is not done now, then when is it going to be done? And how much more expensive is it going to be when the legislature does get around to doing it? Third, there is currently sufficient general obligation bonding authority available for the project. Fourth, the design phase work has largely been completed at considerable expense, I might add, around $25 million, and this investment should not be wasted. We do not want it to become another bridge project. The clock is ticking. According to the people with the expertise, it's not a question of whether, but rather a question of when a large earthquake is going to occur. The experts also say that this building cannot survive the big one. So who is going to be in the building when it happens? And what happens to them? Or should I say us? And what will it then cost to rebuild the building? This building and I are the same age, and we both need rehabilitation. While I might be beyond help, this building is not beyond help. Please give Senate Bill 707 a chance. Thank you for the opportunity to be heard, and if you have any questions, I'll try to answer. Thank you for letting me go through the entire testimony, sir.
We indulge all kinds of people in here, even ones who, you know, take my flag down. Questions? Then we'll have the next panel come up, and the next panel is Michael Custer, Jane Cease.
Jane.
Okay? And then I'll ask, I think, Mr. Ellis to come up, too.
Mr. Chair, who do you want me to go ahead?
You guys can fight it. Generally, it's ladies first, but you know, sometimes in this 21st century, you never know who's supposed to go first.
Oh, I'll take it any time, Mr.
Chair.
Well,
then, madam, you are first to proceed.
My name's Jane Cease, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I'm a former state representative and a former state senator, and so I spent a few years working in the building. But before that, back in 1973 and 74, I was appointed to the Legislative Improvement Committee by President Bowe and Speaker Lang, and we recommended several things. One was staffing improvements, one was public access and information improvements, and the other was facility. And from those recommendations and from that particular facility recommendation came the Capitol wings that we're sitting in today. And then later I served on the Public Commission on the Legislature, which recommended the improvements to the to your office spaces. So I've sort of spent a few years caring about the building. But I'm here today as a current member of the Oregon State Capital Foundation Board, and one of our statutorily recommended directives is to let you know, let the legislature know what we think needs to be done to renovations, to repairs and additions to the state capitol. I have attached to my testimony a description of what is likely to happen to the building when, not if, but when we have a magnitude 9 or so earthquake on the Oregon coast, the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. There are some inevitabilities about living on the earth, and we don't know for sure the timing of those inevitabilities, but for sure we are due to have the big earthquake sometime from today on, and not too far out. But when that happens, I think we have to make sure that this building is safe for everyone who works in it and everyone who visits it. And there are about 200,000 visitors who come to the building every year. A lot of those are school kids. There can be over 200 school kids a day. Last Thursday when I was here, there were a lot, and I asked visitor services. They said there were over 260 school kids visiting the Capitol in that day. If they and any other visitors are in the rotunda, they could get crushed when it falls on them. If they try to run out of the State Street doors, the marble slabs outside are likely to fall on anyone running out because they're not shored up by anything substantial. And interior walls are also made of unreinforced brick and of hollow clay tiles, and they can detach and collapse on top of anybody on the stairs or also block the stairways, and so there would not be safe exits in that case. You've already paid, as you heard Gary say, for a good design to prepare how we could take care of the Capitol and put it on rollers so it doesn't flop back and forth. It just moves like this. That's a proven technique in other areas. One of the other state capitals in the country, the Marriott Hotel in downtown San Francisco, those areas have been proven in major earthquakes. So this bill can also help take care of this building, and I hope that you will move it on and help it happen. And thank you so much for listening.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Michael Custer. I was the senior project manager for J.E. Dunn, the CMGC, on the pre-construction planning phase of the seismic renovation project for the Capitol. In my testimony today, I will touch on J.E. Dunn's experience with capital renovation projects across the nation and the pre-construction phase of this project. I'll share some takeaways from that experience and comment on the sound foundation Oregon has to move ahead with its capital renovation. J.E. Dunn has extensive experience working with state officials on renovating and restoring their state capitals. We have worked on or are working on capital renovation projects in Minnesota, Kansas, Wyoming, and North Dakota. We performed the base isolation seismic retrofit for Pioneer Courthouse in Portland, and currently we're working in Washington County to seismically upgrade their public services building and their law enforcement center. The Minnesota Capitol, constructed in 1905, is that state's most famous landmark, which is listed on the National Register of Historic Places. Work started in 2010 to restore the building, improve life safety, and ensure its long-term functionality. Work included reclaiming public spaces, raising ceiling heights, restoring murals, adding skylights, and installing historically appropriate elevators. There was a complete overhaul of the mechanical, electrical, and plumbing systems, and the stone exterior was cleaned and a new roof was installed. Of course, the building will now meet seismic standards. It provides upgraded security and connects with a planned light rail stop. Work on the Kansas Capitol began in 2002 and proceeded for over 10 years in six phases to allow the continued use of the building. In addition to seismic retrofitting, work included adding a 561-car underground parking garage and creating underground vaults for additional office space and upgraded mechanical systems, and they added a new visitor center. Here are my four key takeaways from these two and our other capital renovation projects. Historic state capitals are important symbols of the key role played by state government in the lives of citizens. Despite the cost, the public values and takes pride in thoughtful renovations of these spaces to ensure their long-term viability. Seismic retrofitting of state capitals is essential to improve the life safety of the men, women, and children who work in them, visit them, or come to them to express their views on public policy. It is also vital that in time of emergency that the state government has a place to conduct its business. Capital renovations can and should include other aspects that improve access, efficiency, and connectivity of important public spaces. Renovating state capitals is economically smart. It turns existing spaces that may be suboptimal into modern, functioning spaces. It honors the investment the public has made over decades, and it creates jobs and new economic opportunities. As I noted, I personally have been involved with the Oregon Capitol renovation project. Our task as CMGC was to support the design effort with constructability and pricing, as well as to manage any building forensic investigations necessary to assist the design team. We also assisted with pricing the temporary capital relocation options, which there were 26, and with constructability and pricing of the temporary capital design once an option was chosen. As part of our work, we conducted significant building investigations and testing to provide the design team with the best data available to produce the most efficient and lowest cost design, which you now have. More than 100 concrete cores and more than 60 masonry investigation tests were carried out to give the structural engineer accurate strength data for critical design calculations. Without this actual data, and the structural engineer would have had to assume much lower structural values, and it would have increased the seismic structure and cost significantly. Other key investigations that were done included multiple surveys of the Capitol grounds. We included every hardscape point and tree, we confirmed the boundary survey, and we mapped the underground utilities. There are significant vaults on the grounds, and this helped the team understand and minimize future utility relocation costs. We did test wells and pump tests to assist with permanent dewatering design. Your capital is served by three different groundwater aquifers, which we didn't know. We did geothermal conductivity tests, an option that was later rejected. We drilled actual micro piles into the basement to assure pile strength could be achieved so that we'll get better pricing on that component when it's time to do the job. Mechanical, electrical, and plumbing systems assessments were done, and energy monitoring was complete. The masonry exterior wall strength tests were completed, and investigation of the exterior marble connections. The exterior marble is 6 inches thick. It has just a few connections to that thin masonry wall. It's quite amazing. We utilized 4D video modeling to confirm the project sequencing for base isolator seismic construction. In short, the work we performed led to a design that is efficient and cost-effective. Many significant risks were identified and averted or minimized. Your master plan is a solid piece of work and should be followed. Let me conclude with comment about economic impact. Renovation of the Oregon Capitol was projected to be a $220 million construction piece. That's a lot of money, but it's also a significant economic driver. The job would generate more than $130 million in labor, or roughly 2 million man hours. That's more than 200 workers would be employed per month during the duration of the renovation, and more than 1,500 different workers would be needed for the project. My last piece of advice is to call your attention to the importance of the temporary capital space. Selection of temporary space is very complex and requires adequate time for proper vetting, fit out, and move preparation. You want this identified as early as possible to lessen confusion, lower cost, and ease anxieties about how the public's business will continue while construction is underway. Thank you.
Questions? So let me ask you a couple of questions. Have you actually read the bill?
I perused parts of it, actually. It took me a while to find it.
Page 2, because I'm going to ask you a trick question here, and you don't have to answer it if you don't want to, but page 2, line 16, actually 17,
it says that the way the bill is written right now, it would cover expenses related to seismic and life safety improvements at the state capitol. Is that the $220 million figure that you quoted, or is this a narrower scope?
The $220 million figure I quoted was the construction cost. That was the cost we delivered at the end of the project. The project's overall cost was much higher because of the added soft costs that went to it. But that was the projected cost at the time back in 2015 for the construction portion.
Because I was looking at this seems to be narrow. It talks about seismic and life safety improvements at the Capitol. So I was trying to figure out the definition of that, which you don't know, but that's okay.
I'm sure you get a lot of different answers to the definitions of that. We followed, the definition for us was we followed very closely the seven items that were outlined within the master plan. We used the master plan pretty much as our handbook as to, you know, what we should go after and what we shouldn't.
Mm-hmm. And does your firm, you made mention the Pioneer Courthouse Square. I'm assuming then that your firm has some seismic experience that's actually worked?
Yes, yes. So, the thing about the Pioneer Courthouse was that it actually used base isolators, the same as the system here. Base isolation system is one of the more complex systems utilized, and so not a lot of people have experience with that.
Is that project complete now or still under project?
Yeah, that project's complete. That was back in 2002 to 2005, 2004. That was the actual courthouse that they literally went in, took the foundation out from under it, and put it on roller skates.
Great. It's still up on the hill when the soil starts going, so it'll be interesting. Appreciate it. Any other questions? Thank you very much. I actually have somebody else from the Portland City Club signed up.
Thank you.
Is there someone from Portland City Club here that wanted to testify, or is it a mistake?
No, he was.
Huh?
Mr. Chair, he had another hearing.
Mr.
Chair, members of the committee, he also left information for everybody in writing, so I'll have that on all of us.
Okay. Senator Courtney, would you like to provide us any insight into Senator Roblin's? You see, I read this here. This seems to be a narrower focus versus a wider focus, and I thought you might have some insight.
Well, you asked me, Your Honor, if I may be asked to go to the witness stand and speak with you.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm asking.
Your Honor, therefore, I take that as an order to go to the witness stand, and therefore, I will obey your orders. Thank you.
And Mr. President, just so you know, as you go down there, that leaves the committee room in my control as the chairman, so I will prevent your staff from stopping you, okay?
Thank you.
Hey, no speeding.
Learned and High Chair O'Chris, may I ask the representative, the Honorable Representative Gary Wilhelms, to come to the table?
I always look for an opportunity after what happened
today.
He can please join you. He can't bring a flag, though, by the way.
He has a long memory.
I paid for that, by the way, at your request, former representative.
Your Honor, since I've been ordered to go to the witness stand to speak with you and other members of the committee, I will identify myself as Peter Courtney. I'm a state senator from District 11, and I've been ordered not to testify on this bill by staff, as well as not to speak to Senate Bill 707. Therefore, I will not testify on the bill. But if I had testified, this is what I would have said had I testified to the bill. In 1993, we got a wake-up call. A magnitude 5.6 earthquake struck Scotts Mills 20 miles away. The Arden Capitol was badly damaged. It was called the break quake. It happened at a time when the spring break was underway. Engineers recommended 5 different upgrades to make the Capitol safer. The legislature did the bare minimum. I was here, so I'm responsible for the bare minimum, and I'm not proud of it. We voted to fix the dome and put off the 4 other needed improvements. In 2006, the Public Commission on the Oregon Legislature told us again the Capitol needed to be made safe. In January 2013, the Capitol Master Plan Review Committee recommended that the legislature make seismic safety and other improvements to the Capitol. Again, I am not testifying, but if I were to testify, this is what I would have said. It was a unanimous recommendation. House and Senate Democrats and Republicans, city and state, contractors and engineers, members of the public, we all started this together. From 2013 until this current legislative session, we worked together. We involved everyone, legislators, staff, the lobby, the community, everyone. Everyone's input was put to use. We created a plan. And then in 2015, we abandoned that plan. We took the $25 million that we had invested into planning and preparation, and we chose not to go forward. Those funds were wasted. You all know how I felt about that. You all know how I feel about that. But I'm here today to look forward and to not testify, to look to this Capitol's future. This piece of legislation is the first step towards the future. With the issuance of these bonds, we will be able to finally retrofit the public spaces in our Capitol, Oregon's Capitol, the people's Capitol, the people's house, the rotunda, the chambers, the hallways, the committee rooms. 10 years ago, we invested in remodeling the wings of this building. 10 years ago. If the big one hits today and you're in those wings, you will likely survive. Which means if that hits now, you all survive. If this committee was in the Indian Service Committee room, 350, 50 or 350 or 50 downstairs, you would not survive. The same cannot be said for the rest of this great building. Every year, 2,035,000 people visit this great capital, this great place, including 20,000 school children. On average day during a session, 1,000 people are in our hallways in this beautiful place. The folks testifying in the committee rooms or the kids marveling at our rotunda. Our public servants working in the JPRO on the third floor, a new agency that we created to help us do the business of the people. Anyone in the chambers, public officials on the floor, or citizens in the gallery are at risk. People in those public spaces when the quake hits will likely not survive. The nuns taught me that you leave a place better than you found it. Well, the heart of this building is in a worse shape today than in 1981 when I first came here to serve. That breaks my heart. I was told not to say this last paragraph, therefore I will not say the last paragraph. But if I did say the last paragraph, I would say the following. The legislature needs to get the job done. We know the quake is coming. We know this building is not safe. We know how to fix it. We know what it will cost. It is time for the legislature to act. I was also told not to talk about the children. Therefore, I will not talk about the children. Had I talked about the children, I would have said that in the last hours, our visitor services prepared a document for me, which I believe is now before you, which speaks to the total number of students and tours that have place, taking place or will take place in the month of March alone. I will not say the figures, but if I had said the figures, there are 2,007 students that will be in this building when the March, when this month is finally closed. We're averaging 125 students a term. But then again, as I said, I was asked not to testify. I did not testify, but had I testified, that's how I would have testified. Thank you, Chair, Colonel. I always obey your orders.
So we can't ask him any questions, can we?
Because he doesn't exist.
He doesn't exist. He can't testify.
But Mr. Wilhelms is here, and he'll be happy to answer the questions for you.
For him, sir?
Take the questions.
I'll be happy to take whatever questions you have.
Questions over there?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
The good chair talked about what was in the bill, but we've heard other rumors that we would have new facilities built, new dining rooms, and new rooms for lobbyists and stuff. Are those included?
They're included in the master plan, yes. Are they included in the technical language of this bill? It would appear that the language would have to be expanded to accommodate not only the examples you gave, but there is the master plan calls for a lot of additional working space for the legislature, hearing rooms and multi-purpose rooms in the building. You know, I don't know how much detail you'd like to go into as far as the design, but anyway, it does increase the square footage of usable space for the legislature in terms of offices and hearing rooms. But and I think the language of the bill would probably have to be amended to accommodate that.
Follow up, please. If the president was able to answer the question, he would probably say that we should do it now because everybody's in here working. And if we have to vacate the building, we might as well get it done all at one time for safety, security, and a new uplifted building, if he could answer that question. But my assumption is he can't. So, Mr. Wilhelm, would you answer that question?
Yes.
I think the answer is yes, sir.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so let me throw a couple of things out here. According to the work schedule,
am I correct there?
This is what's scheduled on the 6th, right? That right there is actually just those right there. Mr. President, so now you do have to answer the question, because I can't put you under oath, and that would be probably the first time in 100 years, and I've already done the 35-year mark on putting people under oath, so you don't want to do that one, I'm sure. It seems to me that at this point what we should look at prior to proceeding with moving the bill, I guess you heard what I said, right, is we really need to go back and look at the CAMS report right now and see where we're at, so we have that on record. We need to review the legislative continuity plan to make sure it integrates with what is being proposed by Representative Senator Roblin here. We need to drag the governor's people in here to figure out what their emergency cabinet continuity plan is to integrate with this, because I know where they're going, and I think there's one culvert between here and there, and it's, you know, probably not going to sink into the world. And then get a better grasp of, you know, how and what we would fix under the master plan, those sorts of costs, and whether that integrates with what we're going to have to do. Because for those who don't know, as soon as the earth starts shaking and the governor goes to the emergency cabinet plan, we automatically come into session. And as you all know, and the good representative, right, knows that sitting behind you to your rear there, knows that a lot of the buildings where we would think we would stay aren't going to exist. So the future plan to use this as the symbol of recovery means that there's probably got to be a little bit more integration, because there isn't going to be a place for the surviving legislators to stay. We're going to have to resolve those sorts of issues. So what I'm sort of saying here is going to carry over the bill till April 6th, in which people who can testify, not those who cannot testify, those who can testify, so that we can put some clarity, get an update for the committee of where we are in the CAMS, where it is we need to go, so that we don't send a makeshift piece of paperwork downstairs. Sound logical to you, former representatives?
Yes, sir, it does.
Would you like to, do you feel comfortable, Senator?
Chair, Colonel Boquist, Vice Chair of Monsignor, and Senator Olson, I'm not answering the question, but I've been ordered to do so. Therefore, I will answer the question, Your Honor. The answer is yes.
Because there's
you need to know, given where we're at right now, in terms of there is construction taking place in the building now, we need to, and I think you beautifully and comprehensively integrated what we're doing now.
Right.
And where we would try to go, I think that's the most comprehensive and the most reasonable, as well as the appropriate, proper way to proceed, Your Honor.
And we do, I mean, we have people that, as you know, I work with that group, so I'm familiar with this, but we really need to get, if we're going to undertake either Article N versus what has been proposed here, Q bonds, we need to have a little further in-depth discussion of, you know, how to proceed and how to go forward. But the single most important thing that we're actually missing is that we haven't done yet is the integration with the governors, because we know where the governor's going. Not speaking politically, we know when there's an emergency where she goes. But that whole integration piece, because the state turns into a pumpkin, and what has sort of changed is we now have a constitutional series of things that the legislature must do and must accomplish, or else the governor runs out of the energy and horsepower to do much of anything. So if there's anyone else that wants to testify, if not, we're going to...
Mr. Chair, yeah? May I ask another question? I had the distinct honor to go to the governor's office after 6 years of being here. It's the first time I'd ever been in the governor's office. I hope it's in the plans to fix that thing. That's a little rat hole. And I hate to say that, Mr. President, but that office is not fitting the governor of Oregon. And I don't know if it's in there or not, but...
You don't need to speak, please.
Please, don't.
Right. Rat hole. That's an interesting description.
Well, it is.
So, Council, if you would, please, what we'll do is we'll reschedule for another public hearing on April 6th. And we do want to reach out to legislative administration so that they can bring in the project manager that's doing the CAMs now, along with identifying, asking either Mr. McNaughton or Ms. Coba to come in about the governor's emergency cabinet and continuity plan, and then see if we can get the available information and the updates. We can coordinate that as we go along. And then I would suspect that before we move the bill, we'll have to do some amendments to the way it's written. So, another question? If not, we're going to close the public
hearing. Mr. Chair?
Yes?
Since we have one more bill, Mr. Chair, would you like to recess it in case Senator Burdick should be the president of the testifying if she could make it and we could return to it?
You want me to buy her 5 minutes? Is that what you're saying? Okay, well, English, okay. Here. We're going to close the public hearing on SB 707, and we're going to recess for 5 minutes.
Oh, sorry, Mr. Chair.
Senate committee will come back to order. We're going to open a public hearing on SB 320. Madam, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 320 appropriates $3,500,000 general fund dollars for the Oregon Military Museum for the 2017-19 biennium. Takes effect July 1, 2017.
There's three chairs. I know it's an infantry task. Count to three. One, two, three.
Okay.
I would thought, you know, maybe we asked with the Marine officer, but, you know, the director's not here, and you're here instead, so I would thought we would.
The guy's just hard, isn't he?
He's a tough loser.
Senator, if you would, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Madam Vice Chair, my name is Alan Olson. I represent Senate District 20, which is the heart of Clackamas County. I had the opportunity last year, and a rainy, murky day like it is now, to go see the Oregon Military Museum. And it is the only military museum that the state owns. It is a state military museum. And it was really wonderful. The folks took me around and showed me all the stuff. And I will ask you to look at the brochure that I left up on your table there. And you'll see a very interesting little artifact where the museum's new name is. If you look way back in the corner, you will see a Civil War cannon. And I was able to stand by that cannon and have my picture taken by it. And that cannon is in pristine shape. And I absolutely love Civil War stuff. So in looking through the facility and looking at what we had available, the new Brigadier General James B. Thayer Military Museum campus at Camp Withycombe needs our support. One of the interesting things about it is, and as many people have asked me, is, well, where does the funding come from? And one of the things that has happened is that Tommy Thayer is a member of KISS, and he's put on concerts, and they've raised $7.5 million. Now, I can't afford the tickets. By far, they are extremely expensive. Mr. Stuckey went, and he took an entourage. I only jest. But they've been very diligently raising money for this museum. And in going through the museum, I have the wonderful curator here. I'd just like to go through a few of the facts of the museum, and they can give you more details to it. But there's 14,000 artifacts that are in storage, and they've been in storage since 2009. And if I get my story right, I believe we moved these around from building to building to building. As they fix sections of building, then they move them back and move them, and they're all in storage. And we're talking artifacts from all of our conflicts. We're talking World War II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the First Gulf War. We have AK-47s. We have RPGs. We have all kind of neat military stuff that is Oregon's history, Oregon's military history. And we can't see it anywhere because we can't get it out and have it displayed. They have 30,000 library volumes, 750 cubic feet of documents that date back to the early 1860s. This is our museum that nobody knows about. Funds for the museum are being raised by citizens of Oregon to complete the construction and artifacts exhibit. So we, the Oregonians, understand how important it is to open this up. It'll be an educational facility for school students and researchers alike. We have one employee entrusted to inventory, preserve, and care for the history of all Oregon veterans' artifacts. The Oregon Military Department will initially use those funds, the funds that we are trying to appropriate, to contract for the design, fabrication, and installation of displays for the Quartermaster Building. I have so many other things to say about it, but the fact is this. There's a brochure on the front, and I've also given you a little layout of the facility that exists. It's kind of a, shall I be honest about it, it's a little bit of a mud hole because they're still working on it, bouncing from building to building. This is important to Oregon's history. We talk about this Capitol as being the heart, the soul of Oregon. Well, the Military Museum is the heart and soul of our military family. It's the heart and soul of our veterans. It shows to the people of our state what our men used in the field and when they sacrificed, when they went out and fought and protected Oregon. And I think this $3.5 million, although it is a large amount of money, the fact is that we can get this museum done, get it open to the public so everyone can enjoy what we have to present to them. And I'm telling you, there's nothing more amazing than to see, I believe it was an anti-aircraft gun that had Japanese, that had the dings on it from the shrapnel. Is that what we had there?
We have some of those, anti-aircraft, anti-tank. It's an incredible 20-millimeter weapon that actually goes sky down to ground.
See, the curator. And I was privileged to be able to see some of this. They opened the vault so I could see some of the weapons, shelves and shelves and shelves of weapons from different eras of our military history. And I feel very strongly in this, and I realize and appreciate the fact that it's a large ask, but it's time we got this facility put together and got it out to the public so that after 9 years we can open it up. And, well, should I say after 9 years? It's been 9 years since the things have been, I guess I'm wrong on it, aren't I? Seven, eight. It's been a lot of years that it's been in storage. It's time to get it out for the people to see and take advantage of our history. And I thank you, and I'll take any questions.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, I'm Dave Secchi. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. The second half of the OMD speaking duo, the better half, is going to be Tracy and Sheila Theonis, and Sheila in this discussion. But we're really happy to have this discussion about the Brigadier General James Thayer Oregon Military Museum. This is General Thayer is one of the true great World War II veterans of our state. We're happy to have this museum named after him. This has been a project that's been going on for a number of years. Just a little bit of background. Officially, Senate Bill 320, where OMD is neutral on this bill. But just a little bit of background about the museum. It's been closed since November of 2008. And so we had to go through a base realignment, a post-realignment of Camp Withicum. We had a number of things going on, from building a new Armed Forces Reserve Center to maintenance build-out to range closures. And so we've had to piece and parcel this museum to get this thing to the state that it is today. And it's not open yet. We hope to have it open here in the very, very near future. It also has some federal funding associated to it. So at the end of this federal fiscal year in September, we're standing there at NGB with our hat in hand trying to get some federal monies to help support this museum also. But as Senator Olson has stated, we're really fortunate to have this private-public partnership with the Oregon Military Museum Project and Tommy Thayer. He is one of four sons to General Thayer. He has done a great job, a great vision in trying to help produce the funding needed to make this museum the best museum west of the Mississippi. And quite frankly, I'm not betting against it. I think he's going to do it. And I think there's going to be a lot of people that are helping support it, as well as our curator, Tracy Thonis. We also have a council that helps support this. General Stencil needs a lot of help in endeavors in terms of this museum, and more is better in his mind. And so we also have a council that's composed of some really energetic as well as hardworking volunteers, and it's led by retired General Dan O'Halloran, that has been out there supporting it from the get-go. But I would just like to say thank you for this opportunity. Thank you for the ability to speak on our Oregon Military Museum, the state's military museum. And at this time, I could take questions, or I could turn it over to our curator.
Good afternoon. My name is Tracy Thonis. I'm Chairman Boquist and honorable members of the Senate. Thank you for having us here. And you, Senator Olson, the sponsor of this bill. I started at the Oregon Military Museum in 2003. I started my museum career back in 1983, and I moved to Oregon in 2000 to open the Evergreen Aviation Museum, which we did a year later, and we welcomed a quarter of a million visitors. So it's tourism dollars as well. The museum at the Oregon Military Museum will be free. There is no admission charged. It's federally reimbursed kind of museum. I recognize that the Oregon Military Department is officially neutral on Senate Bill 320 due to its financial nature. At the same time, I'd like to share with you a little bit about the museum, what we do, and our true mission is to educate and inspire the public as we honor and commemorate Oregonians' military service. We were established in 1975 by a Senate, Oregon Revised Statute 396.555. It is the official repository for the state for military weapons, documents, artifacts relating to the citizens of Oregon. Its collection was detailed by Senator Olson. 14,000 artifacts currently, 30,000 library volumes, 75 file cabinets of documents that date back to paying Indian War veterans. Naval militia. Did you know Oregon had a naval militia? I know our time is short, but I'd like to share two short stories with you that have actually personally impacted me regarding these 14,000 objects. One is the story of a young lieutenant from Portland who, after spending a total of 62 days in combat with the 71st Infantry Division in Europe in World War II, was the first to enter a concentration camp called Gunschgartenlager. It was in Austria. It was a sub-camp of Mauthausen. The tragedy that he witnessed there, of thousands of dead bodies everywhere, along with 10 to 15,000 nearly starving Hungarian Jews, changed him forever. And he still, to this day, will not speak often of it. His family did not even know about this event in his life until they were well into adulthood. Yet he remained in military service his entire life. He attained the rank of Brigadier General within the state. He was a civic leader. He served 30 years as Oregon's civilian aide to the Secretary of the Army. You may recognize his name. It's James B. Thayer, for whom the museum is named. He is a recipient of a Silver Star and the Bronze Star for his valor in World War II.
One of the Thayer-related objects in the museum is the commemorative scarf actually presented to him by Mr. Wolf Sinkman. He was one of the freed prisoners. Mr. Sinkman presented it 50 years later and said, "Without you, I would not be here." The second story is about starts with a kind of little known fact. How many women, well, who were the first women, military women, to ever be become a prisoner of war? This was a Civil War Army contract doctor, Dr. Mary E. Walker. The second time ever that women, military women, became held by an enemy and prisoners of war was in World War II. 67 Army nurses and 11 Navy nurses were captured in the Philippines and held for nearly 3 years. One of them was an Oregonian. Her name was Vivian Wiesblatt Shriver. She was in the Army Nurse Corps. She served as a dietitian. She joined the Army in 1941 and went to the Philippines. Manila fell in late 1941, and all of the nurses were evacuated to Bataan. From Bataan, when that fell, in the middle of that, they evacuated to Corregidor. And at Corregidor, they were taken captive and eventually interred at Santo Tomas Manila Camp until they were liberated almost 3 years later, February the 7th, 1945. At the camp, she served as the dietitian for 600 children, very meager rations, trying to equitably split them. And then she was actually wounded during the liberation of the camp, trying to evacuate kids. To name just a few of her military awards, which are at the museum, she has received the Distinguished Unit Citation to Oak Leaf Clusters, the Bronze Star, the Purple Heart, the Asiatic Pacific Campaign with 2 battle stars, and the Philippine Defense Medal with 1 star. Her brother, Phil Shriver, presented her medals to the museum. He only flew 100 missions in P-39s and then was actually sent back home in early 1943. His story is just as amazing as his sister's and General Thayer's and all of the other people whose artifacts are in the museum. These truly amazing, irreplaceable treasures, this is what defines Oregon military history. These artifacts serve as evidence of Oregonians' service to state and nation. And they represent very tangible ways that we teach the values of military service. Duty, honor, endurance, good citizenship, and valor. Very briefly, from 75 through 2009, the museum was located in several small buildings on Camp Withicum. We hosted approximately 4,000 visitors per year, unadvertised, but yet we've documented them as each year coming from 25 different states and 10 foreign countries. So we were a destination, so to speak. As a result of the massive Department of Defense base realignment of 2005, we were relocated in 2009 to the 1954 Clackamas Armory, the old original armory on the base. It gives us wonderful opportunities for growth, and we can improve our services and ways to fulfill our stated mission, which is to inspire and educate and meet our professional stewardship obligations to care for all these artifacts. However, this move presented some significant challenges. When we moved in this building, it had many unfunded maintenance needs, 30 active leaks, no air conditioning, no climate control, a World War II dated hot water boiler, corroded pipes overhead that dripped, and the radiator spewed black soot on the steam. Not a great place for a museum. But as we have gotten funding available, the building's issues are being addressed. We're on our way. And in the meantime, we continue to provide lots of services. We answer about 150 military research requests a year. We still host our annual Living History Day. If you come out on Armed Forces Day, May 21st, you will see a wonderful amalgamation of living history encampments and military vehicles. We'll host about 1,000 visitors that day annually. We take our displays and our interpreters to community events, and we actually also loan out our artifacts all over the state. So for me, this museum exemplifies an extraordinary effort to preserve the history of some of you who are also veterans and anyone who has served and is an Oregonian. We want to create hands-on family activities, meaningful learning experiences that will help people understand and grow their grow from their experience of visiting the museum. To quote our brochure, the men and women of Oregon's military history deserve a special place for future generations to come and learn about their sacrifices and their triumphs. And I'd like to invite you all to a red carpet tour. Let me know when you're on the base, and I will show you some of those wonderful things, as we did Senator Olson. Again, I thank you very much, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Just comment. I had the opportunity of having a brief tour, and very, very, very impressed. And I truly do believe it would be the only military museum on the West Coast. Is that correct?
You have Joint Base McChord with Fort Lewis Military Museum.
Oh, okay.
So there is one at Joint Base
in
Lewis McChord.
Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah. But what I like about it is it is going to be a huge, huge tourist attraction. And what an educational facility for our kids in particular. And so that's why I do get very excited about the growth of this museum.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Isn't there a 41st Brigade anniversary coming up?
Hey, Chair Boquist, there is 100th anniversary, and we're going to be celebrating that on Saturday. In fact, you RSVP'd, if I'm not mistaken.
So I'm just making sure that I missed something. Because you made no mention, Deputy Director, here, and I was like, okay, maybe I'm spacing out.
No, sir. I recall your name on the list. And in fact, Tracy will be up there on Saturday. So if you have some time, we'd love to show that off. Or more importantly, she would love to show it off.
I wasn't invited.
Sorry.
You probably need to check with your staff. You probably were. I don't think there was anything special about my invite. It was along with the other 90 members of this building, right? At least that are surviving today until the earthquake. So, thank you very much. Appreciate the information. Is there anyone else that wants to testify on SB 320? If not, thank you again. Appreciate the information.
We're going to bring the public
hearing to a close, and that is our business for the day, colleagues. Where'd she go? And that is our business for the day, colleagues.